From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, despite the efforts of Democrats, the State House moves forward a voter restriction bill. As new laws go into effect on September 1st, the George Floyd Act won't be one of them. What are we missing? A livestock dewormer is the quack medicine of choice for anti-vaxxers, and it's making people sick. And billionaire Elon Musk wants to sell Texans electricity. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Late Thursday night, the Texas House of Representatives moved forward a version of SB 1, a controversial voter restriction bill. State Representative Andrew Murr, a Junction Republican, authored the legislation and defended it during the 12 hours of debate.
It is a very important topic to the state of Texas, and I move passage.
Have all members voted? There being 79 ayes, 37 nays, SB 1 is passed to third reading.
Before the floor debate began, Speaker Dale Phelan made an unusual request.
As we debate SB 1, the chair would appreciate members not using the word racism this afternoon.
Democratic Representative Rafael Enchia of Dallas challenged why the bill was actually needed.
There is no reason for this bill. This is all about furtherance of big lie of the big lie. And I want you to think for a minute, with no examples of voter fraud.
During the floor debate, there was an interesting exchange between Representative Aaron Zwiener, a Democrat of Driftwood, and State Representative Kyle Biederman, a Republican from Fredericksburg. Zwiener proposed an amendment that would have prevented anyone who participated in the January 6th Capitol insurgency from being an assistant to a voter. Biederman, a supporter of Texas secession, attended the Trump rally outside the U.S. Capitol on January 6th.
The Capitol insurrection this past January was a true attack on American democracy, and those involved should not be allowed anywhere near our elections.
So is your amendment that anybody that attended that rally is part of the insurrection?
The language is, I have never participated in or encouraged an act of insurrection. As to the motivations and actions of someone who attended a rally, I'll have to leave that to them and their conscience.
So what does your amendment say?
It would add to the statement that that it's someone who assists the voter makes, and I have never participated in or encouraged an act of insurrection against the state or the federal government.
Again, what is your amendment actually
said? I don't think we should get into a back and forth about our individual actions regarding insurrection, Representative Biederman.
What? The amendment is all about the insurrection that you're claiming on January 6th. Yeah, you were not there. You don't know what happened. All you're doing is listening to the liberal media. Is that correct? Where'd you get your information?
Representative Biederman, do you believe the events of January 6th were an insurrection?
Ladies, time has expired.
Of course not.
Zwiener's measure ultimately failed. I spoke with Sean Morales Doyle of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law about SB 1 and its implications for voting rights in Texas.
It means that it's likely to get harder to vote in a state where it was already harder to vote than it was in most places. The bill that moved through the House is a little different than the bill that passed out of the Senate, but both of them restrict voting rights. Unfortunately, this is a trend that extends beyond the borders of Texas and that we've seen in a number of places around the country this year.
The Speaker Phelan asked the members to avoid using the word racism in their debate. What does that tell us?
It tells us that they want to avoid having the conversation about what's really going on here. They don't want to talk about this as if it is something related to race, when I don't think there's any question that it is. We saw record turnout in Texas and across the country last year, but that included a growing population of voters of color in Texas and across the country. There's still a really big gap between the turnout among white voters and the turnout among voters of color, but we saw more voters of color turning out, and the population of Texas is changing, and it is at that moment that Texas is responding by making it harder for folks to vote. And so whether the speaker wants to acknowledge it or not, there's no getting around the fact that race is a big part of this equation.
So when the speaker says, members, I don't want y'all to use the word racism in this debate, and I'm highlighting that in my reporting, am I making something out of nothing, or is that significant?
I think it's significant. I mean, if members of the Texas legislature think that there is racism involved in the passage of a bill to restrict voting rights, then they should say so. And the speaker shouldn't be trying to censor that kind of a conversation. You know, we are right now in the middle of a moment when our Congress is considering passing legislation, and the House of Representatives just passed legislation earlier this week to restore the Voting Rights Act of 1965 in order to give full protection against race discrimination in voting across the country. They did that after compiling a record that amply demonstrated how much discrimination, race discrimination in voting we still have around the country. It's a real problem that we're still grappling with. And it's something that the Texas legislators should feel free to discuss as they're considering making it harder for people to vote in that state. And so I do think it's significant that the speaker wanted to avoid having that conversation.
So there's a lot in this bill. Bans 24-hour voting. Does make it harder to vote through mail. It does ban drive-through voting, things like that that impact actual voting process. But there's also a large component of it protects and gives more agency to these partisan poll watchers. That seems to be really the thing to look out for.
Voter intimidation has been a problem for a very long time in this country. And you know, partisan actors at the polls certainly raise concerns about voter intimidation. I think that we are more concerned about that issue now than maybe in recent years for a number of reasons, including some of the incidents that we saw in Texas and elsewhere last year. And so it is concerning that the Texas legislature is giving more power to partisan poll watchers and importantly, limiting the authority of poll workers and elections officials to do something about poll watchers that are acting inappropriately. And that's maybe the trend that's most obvious about this legislation in a number of ways, is that it is a restriction on poll workers and election officials and what they can do. And that's really significant after a year where we saw election officials come under attack in a way that we've never seen it before. And so there's not just reason to worry about voter intimidation. There's reason to worry about people going after poll workers and elections officials. And after those folks really preserved our democracy during a very trying time, running elections during a pandemic in 2020, it's a shame that the Texas legislature is now really going after them. And limiting their ability to do what they need to do to run smooth and secure elections.
When democracies die, they don't really just die from one day to the next. It's really a slow turning off of the oxygen in the room, and little by little, and suddenly you realize there's no more oxygen. Is that what we're experiencing right now? Without federal protection of voting rights, we're seeing the cutting off of the oxygen for democracy.
I do think we are seeing a trend across the country, certainly focused in certain states, of restricting access to the right to vote. We're seeing it happen at a time when our federal laws protecting against race discrimination in voting have been weakened multiple times by the Supreme Court. We're seeing it at a moment that is really a troubling moment for our democracy, at the same time as we saw, you know, some real signs of just how resilient and healthy our democracy was last year. We also saw unprecedented attacks. We saw the big lie leading to, you know, armed attempt at insurrection. We're in a tenuous moment. And unfortunately, the Texas legislature and others are responding to that moment by trying to make it harder to vote. And I do think that given the moment that we're in, that is particularly concerning, and we have to be worried about where we're heading. And it is why it is so important that the U.S. Congress act now to restore the protections of the Voting Rights Act and to set a baseline for what elections should look like across the country with the For the People Act.
Sean Morales Doyle is with the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law. On September 1st, over 600 new laws passed in the last legislative session will go into effect. You'll be able to carry a handgun without a permit or any training. You'll be able to buy beer and wine earlier on Sundays. Abortion is further restricted and banned after 5 weeks of pregnancy. Fact-based history of Texas oppression against African Americans and Latinos cannot be taught in public schools, and many more new laws. But one law that will not be going into effect on September 1st is the Texas George Floyd Act, because it didn't pass. There was one police reform bill that did pass. Police officers will now be required to keep their body-worn cameras on during investigations, but no George Floyd Act. Darrell Douglas is a community organizer and the executive director of Houston Justice.
Last year, in the heat of the summer, in the midst of this pandemic, we saw across the nation hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people that participated in protests, that participated in actions, all calling for some form of accountability. And in the state of Texas, that came through the form of the George Floyd Act. And even some of the simplest things that the bill would have done were shot down by the powers that be. And it's really a shame, because Texas really has the opportunity to say, we're going to put action, and we're going to put some concrete legislation behind police accountability towards ending police brutality. They had the opportunity, and basically at every opportunity, they turned away from it.
The laws that do go into effect actually will make it harder for people to protest the next time there is an outrage. There's a new law that says people who will block emergency vehicles could be arrested, because during the protest, we saw people taking to the streets.
Exactly. After September 1st, it's going to have higher consequences when people choose to take to the streets. I think Dr. King said it best, Dr. Martin Luther King, when he said, riot is the language of the unheard. So I think many of us, in 2020, similar to what happened on Bloody Sunday back in the 60s, saw the most purest form of pushback in the form of the protests that happened in city centers across the nation. And it's really a slap in the face to say, not only did we not take any action on actually addressing the issues that are clearly there, but we're going to make it harder for you to point it out and harder for you to bring attention to it. And to be honest, I do not think that's going to have really any impact on any of the activism or any of the protests. I think everyone who was on the streets last year were there knowing the consequences that existed. I have friends, teachers even, who were swept up in paddy wagons that weren't even amongst some of the rioters or looters, people that just happened to be downtown that were swept up, that were forced to have to go to court and plead their case. And many of those cases were dropped, but it further demonstrates the strong arm of police brutality, that even when you're protesting, police brutality will use it against you to calm the unrest instead of addressing it.
So the George Floyd Act, it was a package of different reforms that would have limited police chokeholds, would have required officers to intervene if a fellow officer was using excessive force. It also required agencies to adopt use of force policies that emphasized de-escalation, and it would take away some of police qualified immunity, which is a legal shield from state civil rights lawsuits.
We didn't get any of those things, and what's really ironic about this whole thing you know, today I'm executive director of Houston Justice, but a little over 10 years ago, I was a lieutenant for the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. I actually wore a uniform. I actually swore to provide public safety and to protect and serve this state. And I've participated in uses of force, and I understand firsthand the responsibility that comes when you are using force in order to maintain some sort of public safety. And so I find it very ironic that the threshold for care is much higher, even when it comes to the Texas prison system, when compared to free world police officers who you would expect to put up with a lot more. If in 2021, if you think choking someone to death is the only avenue to restraining someone, we've got a lot of work to do. If you think that reaching for your gun is the first reaction, we've got a lot of work to do. And anyone who, after looking at the 8+ minutes of what happened to George Floyd, would go under the dome of any legislature and not see the glaring clarion call to make this right and choose to do something else, it's a shame. It's truly a shame.
Terrell Douglas is a community organizer and executive director of Houston Justice. The Texas Poison Control Center's hotline is burning up with people concerned about COVID who are overdosing on livestock dewormer. The product is ivermectin, and the FDA is warning people not to ingest it. But despite that warning, the product is sold out at ranch and feed stores. Dr. Sean Varney is the medical director for the Texas Poison Center. He says people are calling in with severe symptoms.
Ivermectin has really sparked an interest among the people. And it just happens that, you know, here in South Texas, I guess we have a lot of agriculture and we have a lot of farming with horses and cattle, because that is what this is. This is a deworming agent for the large animals. And people are just thinking that, well, maybe it's good. And you've probably read and heard that, you know, there are articles that have been published in the medical literature touting, I guess, that ivermectin may have a place in either preventing or treating COVID-19, but we have to measure these or look at these articles with a very careful eye, because many of them have not been peer reviewed, meaning they have not undergone the rigorous scrutiny by other scientists, other physicians who also do these studies. And so a lot of information gets put out there and gets accepted at face value, where you can't really do that and hope that the conclusions are accurate. So you just got to be careful.
So you say you have numbers.
If you were to look at just human exposures, that's what we're most interested in. In 2019, there were 191. In 2020, there were 178. And then in 2021, in just 8 months, so January through August, there were 260. So if you were going to prorate that to, well, if we continue on this trajectory with the same use, how many would you have in the full calendar year? That'd be about 390, or roughly double what we've had in 2020 and 2019.
I'm mystified that people were using this back in 2019, that they were self-administering, they were eating it.
So those could be legitimate cases. I wouldn't expect these to be, you know, we didn't have COVID-19 in 2019 to account for that many cases. And I don't even think people had any idea that it should even possibly be tried. So those are probably more legitimate exposures.
Of course, you know, the dose is certainly a big part of this equation.
Yes.
Are people taking the same amount of dose that they would for a cow or a horse, which is, you know, they're like 5-10 times what a person is?
There you go. You just nailed it. So there are human dosing recommendations, but not for human, not for COVID-19. Therefore, how do you treat, lice or scabies, or even to take care of worms? There are human doses. We're talking a very small dose. That would be a dose of about 20 milligrams. That's what a person would take if prescribed by a provider, a physician.
So what does that look like?
It would be a pill, because it would be from a doctor. But these
But people are grabbing, they're buying a tube of this material, and they're squeezing it out onto, I don't know, into their mouths.
Yes, and that's just crazy, because there's no way to tell how much there is. First of all, the medications come as either a paste or a liquid. The paste, they're kind of protected, although it's more concentrated, but there's only so much in the tube. Whereas the liquid, let's say 1% on the bottle, and people think, well, that's probably just like 1 milligram and 1 milliliter, not very much. I better take a lot. But that's actually a lot of medication. So when people are using this and just kind of eyeballing it and guessing, they're getting 10 to 15 times the human dose that you would use for these other indications, FDA-approved indications. So they are overdosing at least 10 to 15 times when they're just kind of, well, I'm just going to take a squirt of this. If I'm just going to take a mouthful, take a swallow of the liquid, it would be roughly 15 times the normal recommended dose for an FDA-approved indication, which is not COVID-19.
So what does that do to a person?
Fortunately, a lot of the symptoms are the same as with therapeutic use, which is just kind of nausea, vomiting, some abdominal pain. However, you can have further problems, including mental status changes, coma, even seizures, and there have been deaths reported. Now, I haven't seen any deaths here in Texas, but these are things that are reported by the manufacturer, and people who use large doses, they are certainly at risk. And we have seen cases here. I just got called the other night about a couple of cases. A family, of course, everybody has COVID-19 and they want to take it. A friend gave them the medication just to treat them and, hey, might as well try it. But they were having temporary visual problems where they were seeing different things, losing part of their vision. So it's just not known what happens when a human takes these very large doses. Another thing is, in these medications, they're intended for animals. So they have different carriers in them or different products to help get them in the bloodstream. And they haven't really been studied in humans either to know what the effect would be, because they weren't ever meant for humans.
So what about people who say, I don't want to get the vaccine, even though now the FDA has approved the Pfizer vaccine?
Yeah, exactly.
But I don't know what's in it. But then they're willing to take horse dewormer.
You nailed it on the head right there. That's exactly it. If you're going to take a risk, why don't you take a risk along with millions of other people? And the data are clear that the vaccinations help. You might still get COVID, but it would be a less severe form. You're less likely to need to be put on a ventilator. You have a breathing tube put on you. You're less likely to die when you have the vaccine. You're less likely to be admitted to the intensive care unit and have a bad outcome. So I agree with you, sir. Let's encourage the vaccine and avoid taking all these medications. This week or this month, these past few months, it's ivermectin. Last year, it was hydroxychloroquine. Bad things happen. What is it going to be next week? There's something else will come along and will take its place.
Dr. Sean Varney is the medical director of the Texas Poison Center. Billionaire Elon Musk has made his money by being an innovator and a disruptor. With Tesla Motors, he revolutionized the auto industry. SpaceX is sending rockets into orbit and landing them back on Earth. And there are other examples. But the latest area that Musk could be disrupting is the Texas power market. Musk has launched a new subsidiary of Tesla called Tesla Energy Ventures, which filed with the Public Utility Commission of Texas to sell electricity on the retail market. Russell Gold is writing about it. He's an editor at Texas Monthly Magazine.
After the February freeze, you would think that everyone was going to run for the hills and try to get as far away from the Texas market as possible. But actually, that's not what's happening. We've seen a bunch of companies coming in, applying to be what are called retail providers, and now Tesla is one of them. And so I think this is going to be a big deal because Tesla, when they get into markets, they tend to be very innovative and they shake things up. And I'm really personally very interested to see what Tesla is going to do with this retail market.
People know Elon Musk for Tesla. the electric car company, maybe also for SpaceX, which is down at Boca Chica outside of Brownsville, which is planning to go take people to Mars. They may know about the Boring Company. He's talking about building tunnels between San Antonio and Austin. These sound like crazy sci-fi ideas. They are crazy sci-fi ideas that he is trying to make real. He's got a robot, a humanoid robot. So why would he want to get into something as mundane as making sure that my toaster works?
Well, he sees that Tesla has said as recently as last year on a call with investors, he thinks that the energy side of Tesla could ultimately be as big as the car side. We know that, you know, we know how big the car side is, but Tesla's already involved in electricity. You know, they'll sell you solar panels. They'll sell you these Powerwall home batteries. And, you know, Tesla didn't return my calls and tweets to try to get him to comment. But I talked to several people in the market about how Tesla could get into this. And what people think Tesla's probably going to do is that they're going to kind of bundle this all together. You know, they'll sell you electricity and solar panels and this home battery, but they'll also sell you a way to bring it all together. Look, the old 20th century way of dealing with your power company is that you buy power from them. It's a one-way relationship. Where we seem to be heading right now is that every house could be kind of a two-way street. Sometimes you're buying power, sometimes you're selling power back onto the grid, or you're selling what are called demand response services. When it's a really hot day, you'll use a little less electricity and get paid for that. Well, Tesla, you know, one of the things they're very good at is sort of integrating their software. If you talk to anyone who's driven a Tesla car, they'll say, you know, the software is just amazing. It's incredibly easy to use. And I wonder whether Tesla's going to come in and start providing some of these services so that you sort of have this whole Tesla house. You know, and for Tesla, it could be a good business. I mean, you know, they are getting into what's being called a retail provider. They want to have their hands very much in how much electricity you're using, when you're using it, how you're relating to the grid. It's sort of this great new era that we're heading into, this 21st century power grid, where everyone's a power provider and everyone's a power buyer, and Tesla wants to be the company that manages that for you.
So Elon Musk says he's trying to save the planet.
Yeah.
If you buy Elon's Tesla power, if he becomes your retail power provider, will it be clean? Will it be green power?
Well, that's a great question. We actually don't know that. It could be. You know, he certainly could go out and contract with wind farms and only buy, buy renewable power from wind farms or solar farms. And, you know, he's building these giant batteries and storing the batteries so it's always available. Or he could be buying power from the nuclear plants or the few remaining coal plants or gas plants. We just don't know all the details yet. We're just going to have to sort of sit and wait right now and see exactly how they roll it out in a couple months. They should have a yay or nay from the state as to whether they can be a retail electric provider by November. So at least we won't have to wait that long.
Russell Gold is an editor at Texas Monthly Magazine. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.